So what I'm going to do, although this will take us a little bit outside of the purgatory proper, is I want to lay out just a little bit about the larger structural questions about the Divine Comedy, which have something to do with the meaning of it. Because Dante, if you've read any of him, you recognize that everything is very carefully calibrated, right? We talked last night about how even the terza rima, the way the three rhymes intertwined with one another, is a kind of a symbol of the Trinity that's woven into the very verse of the Divine Comedy. So to get a sense of this, what I'd like to do is to begin by talking just a little bit about what the difference is between presenting material in a poem and presenting material in a kind of an expository way, the way you would find it in St. Thomas or in, say, Augustine. Okay. And Dante tells us that he deliberately stopped writing a treatise, which was a commentary on his own poems. It's called the Convivio, or the Banquet. He's thinking back to, although he doesn't know Plato, he knows that Plato wrote something called the Symposium, which is a banquet. And he's writing a commentary on his poems, which is something he tends to do. He did that in the Vita Nuova, which is his very first work, when he talks about meeting Beatrice and falling in love with her and then everything that happened. And the Vita Nuova is a bit like the Consolation of Philosophy, if you know Boethius, where there are poems and then there are commentaries on them, and the two things kind of mesh together. So we know that he deliberately decided not to write a treatise, and to write instead a poem. We also know, because he wrote a book called De Vulgare Eloquentia, on the common tongue, or on the vernacular, in which he actually begins to set down the rules that become modern standard Italian. Most Italians can read Dante at least grammatically. Dante's Italian is closer to modern Italian than Shakespeare's English is to our English today. So and that's partly because Dante helped establish what modern Italian was going to be. But he says, in a letter to one of his patrons, he says that he wrote this poem, and he wrote it in Italian, not in Latin, which was the lingua franca of the day, right? If you wanted to be an international scholar, you wrote in Latin and made it possible for everybody in Europe to read it. He said, I wrote it in the common tongue so that even common people, women, children, unlettered men, could partake in the bread of angels. I think it's a very powerful thing for a person at that time to say, and especially a person like Dante. And I can tell you, after years of reading him, he was not a humble man. Now, in his defense, he knows he's not a humble man, too. In a couple places in the Divine Comedy, he says, well, I'm going to have to come back here for a while. I know that. Okay. But what I want to say is this. Although we know we're not dealing with an expository bit of writing, it helps us to keep in mind two figures as we read through the poem. Augustine and Aquinas. There are explicit passages that you could point to that come out of Augustine, and there are explicit passages, I'll read some of them as we get going, that are linked in with Aquinas. But these two figures, Augustine in particular, because he kind of forms the whole background of medieval thought until Aristotle comes in, and then you start to get scholastic thinking as well. But still, he's sort of the foundation. Yeah. And Aquinas, because Aquinas is, he really sets in order this new learning that starts to come in the High Middle Ages, right? I mean, the arrival of Aristotle, that kind of thought. And Dante absorbed that. We know that Dante studied with the Franciscans at Santa Croce. If you've ever been to Florence, Santa Croce is the church that's run by the Franciscans very close to the Biblioteca Nazionale, right along the Arno River. And some people call it the Pantheon of Italy because there are monuments to Galileo and Garibaldi, and there's even a statue of Dante, although the Florentines have a kind of a troubled relationship with Dante. They exiled him, and I think when one mayor of Florence about 10 years ago decided to grant him a reprieve, it's a little late. And there's sometimes a statue of Dante outside of Santa Croce, and sometimes not, but you know, they're Italians, what can I say? So he started with the Franciscans there, and he probably absorbed a lot of that Augustinian side of Catholicism from the Franciscans. But we also know that he studied with Remigio de Girolami, who was one of the early students of St. Thomas Aquinas, and who taught at Santa Maria Novella, which is a beautiful Gothic church over what's now the train station of Florence. In fact, the train station in Florence is called Santa Maria Novella. So if you ever go into Florence on the train station, do yourself a favor and just walk into the piazza that's very close by there and take a look at the Dominican church. So he formally studied both sides of this tradition that comes down to us. One kind of Platonic course and the other kind of Aristotelian course. Now, I think one of the first things you have to notice about the Divine Comedy is that it's a drama. It's a drama that ends up in a comic fashion because it's a happy ending when people arrive at the beatific vision. But all along the way, it's a drama as well. And this is the literary part of it that I think is it's essential to understand. Otherwise, you can just be looking for passages where you get conceptual ideas. That's not what human life is anyway. Human life is this cut and thrust, and you know, it's historical, and it's personal, and it's civic, and it's got all these other elements. And it's easier and an easier and fuller presentation of that, if you're a genius, of course, to present it as these series of encounters that are quite dramatic. And I think that there's a connection here. I don't know if any of you know Hans-Urs von Balthasar, the great modern theologian, but he talks about the theodramatic, how all of human life is a kind of a theological drama that involves us, God, saints, angels, you know, all sorts of other things. And I think that in Dante, you see that in a marvelous way. By the way, von Balthasar wrote a long chapter on Dante in, I think, the second volume of the Theodramatic. I could be wrong about that, but it's worth finding if you can. So, let me try to suggest a little bit about the way that the order of loves and the form, the structure of the comedy interact with one another. There's a funny scene in the novelist Walker Percy's, I think it's Love in the Ruins. I don't know if any of you know Walker Percy, who's a Catholic, now dead, American novelist, very funny, very insightful. And in one of his characters, talks about a neighbor of his who reads Dante for the structure. He says, who reads Dante for the structure? Well, I do. But not the way he means, of course. You know, he's not just reading it like an aesthetic to see how intricately a literary genius could put something together. The structure matters. Because we have 100 cantos, right? We talked about this a little bit last night. 34 in Inferno. There's kind of a one that's an introduction, and then 33 Purgatorio, 33 Paradiso. And 100 is one of those numbers that in any society that values numerology, you can think of that as significant. And then 33, and then, of course, threes, Trinitarian things again begin to show up. But there's even more than that, because if we look at what is each of the cantiche, a cantica is one of those three parts, Inferno, Purgatorio, Paradiso. And there are what are called cantos. It's a little confusing, I know, but there are cantos within the cantica. So there are 34 cantos, 33 and 33 cantos within each of those three cantiche. Right? Inferno is what? It's a story of spiraling down into the abyss of evil. And it's carefully structured. There's an upper inferno, which is mostly about incontinence, meaning people who can't control their appetites. There's a lower inferno that involves malice, and I'm going to talk a bit about more of this and this in the future. But it's very carefully calibrated. All those circles of hell, all the way down to we get to Lucifer, who has three faces. Another Trinitarian reference, but this in this case ironic. He has three faces, and he's chewing. Each one of the faces is chewing on a figure. One is Judas Iscariot, who betrayed his proper Lord, Jesus, and God. And the other two are Brutus and Cassius, who betrayed Caesar, who assassinated Caesar, and therefore rebelled against the proper political order. Dante has a very complicated relationship to Rome, and I'll get to that in a minute as well. But all carefully structured down to that absolute vision of evil, and the poets escape through a little crevasse in the earth, and they come up on this island with a huge mountain. It's purgatory. Purgatory has a number of cornices, cornici, as they say in Italian, that start at the base and then go through the various seven deadly sins. There's pride. I forget what the next one is. All the seven deadly sins going up to the top. As we talked about last night, the top is the earthly paradise, where Dante arrives back at the original position that Adam and Eve had. And then he and Beatrice, his lady love, fly off into the heavens. And even the heavens are structured. In Paradiso, what we have are a series of concentric circles. You know, it's the Ptolemaic system where there's a geocentric system where the Earth is at not the center but the bottom of the universe. I mean, if Earth were the center, then the center of the Earth, Satan, would be the whole point of the universe. And obviously, Satan is not the whole point of the universe for Dante or for anybody else. There's a very good little book on the old Ptolemaic system by C.S. Lewis. It's one of his later books called The Discarded Image. So it's just a short 150, 160 pages, but you know he's got that mastery of being able to explain things, and it just shows you how the medievals thought about the universe that they perceived around them. And it's the Earth being very definitely at the bottom of what is a great height. It goes up from our sphere to the circle of the moon, and then sun and planets and whatnot, and then finally to the fixed stars. And then beyond the fixed stars, where the whole universe kind of turns inside out again, and the center becomes God. It's no longer that it feels to us like we're in the center of the Earth looking up, but it kind of turns inside out, and that's when other things begin to happen. St. Bernard of Clairvaux comes in to lead him up to the ultimate vision. So I wanted to explain all this because this is all carefully structured and it has a great deal to do with the order of love. Now, if you've read Augustine's Confessions, that too is a kind of a drama. It's not a kind of abstract exposition of how Augustine comes to understand himself and understands Christianity. It is clearly a very troubling in a lot of ways because most of the book is about how he keeps going back and forth and can't figure out how to get himself out of the problems that he's in. And eventually he has his conversion experience. So later on, and this is in book 13, Augustine talks about amor meus pondus meum. My love is my weight. Now, what he says about this is interesting, and I'm just going to read a short passage for you. It has something to do with, when he means weight, he doesn't mean weight only that carries us down. If you imagine this world that is structured in an order, where loves assign you to the various circles and cornices and everything else, your weight can actually carry you upwards. In the sense he means. And let me just read this to you. Love lifts us up thither, and thy good spirit advances our lowliness from the gates of death. This is Dante. In thy good pleasure lies our peace. This too is Dante. You remember in Paradise, La sua volontà è nostra pace. His will, in his will is our peace. Our body with its lumpishness strives towards its own place. Weight makes not downward only, but to his own place also. The fire mounts upward, a stone sinks downward. All things pressed by their own weight go toward their proper places. Oil poured on the bottom of the water is raised above it. Water poured above oil sinks to the bottom of the oil. They are driven by their own weights to seek their own places. Things a little out of their places become unquiet. Famous line in Augustine, right? Unquiet is our heart until it rests in thee. Put them in their order again, and they are quieted. My weight is my love. By that am I carried, whithersoever I be carried. And that, I would argue, in spite of all the Thomistic elements, excuse me, Dominicans in the room, all the Thomistic elements in Dante, that Augustinian vision, I think, animates the whole shape of the Divine Comedy. O thou who art love, he says, set my loves in order. And that's precisely what Dante has done. He's set the various loves in order. Now, I just want to remark in passing, this is very different, of course, from our modern idea of what the world is. We kind of think we're in a pluralistic democracy. We kind of think all choices and all loves are on an equal plane. That is not what the pre-modern world thought. It's not what the ancient world thought, Aristotle, Plato, Stoics. It's not what the medieval world thought. It's very, very different from what the classical, the classical and biblical ideas are very, very different from our ideas about these things. And it's a simple truth, I think. I think it just it's confirmed by our own experience that a figure like a Mother Teresa, maybe some of you are on the same spiritual plane that she is, but I would recognize someone like her as quite far above me in the order of loves. And if there is above me, there probably is below me as well. And this is worth pondering. And this is one of the things that by reading Dante, we get a grip on. It's a different vision than our own contemporary vision. Naturally, we're all equal in the sight of God in the sense that we've been created by him and he loves us. But the order of loves is something different. The order of loves begins to show itself in the way that Dante is explicating. Now, Dante had a very profoundly different view than Augustine on Rome. And Augustine lived in late antiquity and had a good idea of what Rome was like in his time, and maybe we have to take his side in this. But one of the things that Dante is thinking about when he's talking about the order of loves is the disorder in the Italian politics of his day. So he looks back to Rome. It's one of the reasons why he reaches back, and Virgil is one of his guides. He reaches back to Rome because he thinks that that was a time that God ordered providentially, so that Christ comes into the world under the peace of the Roman Empire, the Pax Romana, right? And the fact that Rome has got a system of roads and communication and whatnot enables Christianity to travel out from Palestine to the whole then known world. And it's a very different view than Augustine would take, who thought of, if you read The City of God, you know that Augustine thinks that Rome had many virtues, but they were virtues for a kind of a collective egotism. And so they're really vices. They look like virtues, and they kind of are virtues. But in the largest scheme, when you look at the largest ordering of loves, they're in a way vices. Now, there's a convergence, of course, of the two of them in a variety of ways. And we could spend a lot of time. We could spend a lot of time on any of these figures, the way that Thomas enters in or St. Bernard enters into this poem. But it's worth looking at the fact that Dante chose Virgil as his early guide. Now, some of the earlier literary critics who studied the Divine Comedy made that choice into a kind of what I would regard as a bit of a wooden allegory, that Virgil is reason. And Dante is the soul. And Beatrice, you may laugh at this, Beatrice is a vocation to the priesthood. That for a while, that was a that was an idea that seemed to bounce around to some of the people who read Dante. I think we've got to just take these figures as initially, at least, as what they are. There are times when Virgil does represent kind of human reason. There are times when Beatrice does seem to be almost theology or an allegory of theology. But they're people to begin with. They're people that Dante encounters. And when he first encounters Virgil in the dark wood, not only is he happy that somebody is there to help him out, but he's amazed that this poet he's admired for so long, and he's memorized all of the Aeneid, this person is there to actually help him. And that choice, I think, is also a structural choice that tells us something about the order of loves, because although Virgil is not entirely reliable as you go through the Divine Comedy, there are places where he gets played by some of the demons in hell. I mean, human reason is just not up to outwitting some of the deviltry that he finds. And he misreads certain things, too. I'll get to that in a minute. But nonetheless, human reason is capable of helping us through a lot. It's helpful almost entirely through the Inferno. It's helpful to the very top of Purgatory. When Dante is going to enter, again, the earthly paradise, he leaves Virgil behind at that point. And I'm going to look at that scene probably in the next lecture. But you won't see this point of what human reason can do. Virgil is reason without grace. And he's in limbo. He's kind of in hell, as are Plato, Aristotle, and the others. And when Dante portrays them, he says these are great and noble figures. He keeps talking about how noble they are. But they live in a kind of twilight nobility. They don't have the joy and the light and the inspiration that comes from having participated in the Christian revelation. So he's both admiring of them and at the same time recognizing that great as they are, they're limited. Now, I want to look at an early scene. It's a very, very well-known scene, but this too will help us figure out the order of loves and some of the larger structural questions we need to look at. In Canto 5 of Inferno, there's a famous scene of Paolo and Francesca, the two adulterous lovers. Whenever I teach this, by the way, students are shocked that this is the first sin, because they kind of think it's the light. They kind of think that the church is very preoccupied with sex, and why is it that adultery is only at the beginning? And well, I'm going to explain this a little bit, I hope. Early on in that canto, and this is where you have to pay attention to canto by canto as a drama, they meet the judge of the underworld, Minos. Right? And Minos says to them, because Virgil says, you know, this guy's, God wants this guy to go through here, let him in. And Minos says, O you who come to this abode of pain, beware how you come in and whom you trust. Don't let the easy entrance fool you. Now, Virgil, I said, he's not infallible, thinks that Minos is just resisting him, sort of irrationally. But that's not what he's said. He's warned him, be careful about the easiness of the entrance. Don't let the easy entrance fool you. So, some lines later, Dante and Virgil meet Paolo and Francesca. And you probably all know this story, even if you haven't read Dante. Paolo and Francesca were a couple in Rimini. It's a beautiful Italian town up near Venice. And the story goes, we don't know if Boccaccio invented this or in fact it's true, but the story goes that it looks like she married the wrong guy, and he was kind of brutal, he was kind of a wife beater, he was very cruel to her. And in fact, it may have been that his brother came to ask for her hand, and she thought she was marrying the brother who she liked. It's all a soap opera. This is what life is all about. Anyway, so the two of them are up in Rimini, and they start this affair. And they're swirling around. The punishment for the lustful is they never get any rest. They're like leaves or like birds swirling around in this storm, which I guess in terms of hell isn't the worst thing you can anticipate. But they're swirling around, swirling around, swirling around. Finally, Dante says, look, can you just tell me who you are? So Francesca comes out and she does all the talking. She says, "O living creature, gracious and kind, that come through somber air to visit us, who stained the world with blood, if the king of the universe were our friend, we would pray that he might give you peace, since you show pity for our grievous plight." Very gentle, very courtly, very delicate. Contrast with a brutal murder by a jealous husband. But the stinger is in that line, "if the king of the universe were our friend." So in other words, they would like their love to somehow be okay, even though in the larger scheme of things, it's not okay. It may be okay in terms of courtly love at a medieval castle, but in terms of God's ordering of loves in the universe, it's not okay. But for her, it's all love, love, love. This is love talk at the beginning of the actual entrance into hell. She says, "Love, quick to kindle in the gentle heart, seize this man with the fair form taken from me. The way of it afflicts me still. Love, which absolves no one from beloved from loving, seized me so strongly with his charm that, as you see, it hath not left me yet. Love brought us to one death." Now, if you took her at your word, this is love. This is perfectly okay. Dante gets drawn into this fantasy, and as lots of critics have pointed out, he's kind of sympathetic. The way he presents this, he's kind of sympathetic. He knows that this is a tender emotion. This is the kind of a temptation that people feel, but yet they're in hell as a result of this. As I say, when I teach this, students are astonished that this is the lightest of sins. But if you think about it, the reason that it's so attractive is that it kind of imitates the real thing that the whole universe is about, right? It's the affection and the goodwill toward another person. Right? This kind of mimics the divine, even the divine love. That it's wishing well to another person, but not in the larger order of things, not in the order of the ordo amoris. And we know that that leads to a lot of difficulties in our world. Now, there's a scene in Inferno where Dante talks about the shape of Inferno. It's in Canto 11, if you remember that. They've passed into what's called the city of Dis. Dite being one of the demons in hell. It's kind of like the city of man in Augustine, as opposed to the city of God, right? And it's here that the illusions of just sort of the inability to control appetites, whether it's lust, whether it's greed, whether it's hunger, these actually now, we go lower and we turn from being unable to control your own appetites to actual malice. And this is one of the places where Dante partly follows Aquinas and partly doesn't follow Aquinas. What we don't see here, by the way, are the seven deadly sins and the deviations from the virtues or the deviations from the virtues that are in Aristotle's ethics. Dante is actually putting together a different view of his own. And he takes a kind of a position from the broader Latin tradition, Cicero and some others, that it's actually worse to harm a person by fraud, which is to say, by deceiving their reason, than it is to be violent toward a person. And the argument that he uses is a very interesting one. He says that the highest part in the human being is the human reason. And therefore, although it's wrong, it's obviously wrong both to be violent physically against someone, it's also extremely wrong to deceive somebody through fraud. And as you go down those much deeper levels of hell, that's precisely what you see, that there's a kind of an element of that that you would miss if you weren't paying attention to what Dante and Virgil discuss in 11 of Inferno. There's a funny scene, I can't help telling this, it doesn't have a lot to do with what we're talking about here, but it's the funniest scene in all of the Divine Comedy. It's where Dante meets Guido of Montefeltro, who is sort of the first mafia Guido in history. Greedo is a, he's a warrior, and he's famous for figuring out how to overthrow towns. You know, all the medieval cities, city-states are all warring with one another. He's famous for ruses and how to overthrow towns. So he gets near the end of his life, and he decides, this is no good. I'm about to go to the other world. And he decides he's got to repent. So he enters a Franciscan monastery, and he's going through his prayer and fasting and repenting for his earlier life. And Pope Boniface VIII, who was the pope who got partly responsible for getting Dante exiled from Florence, comes to him and says, I need to take the city of Palestrina. Now, if you've ever been on the Via Appia Antica, just south of Rome, you can see Palestrina on the hillside. And this is where the famous musician Palestrina is from. It's a hillside town. And Boniface says to Guido, look, you got to help me do this. Guido says, I don't do that kind of thing no more, you know. But the pope says, look, you can do it just once more for me. You've done it in the past. Do it once more. I'm the pope. You know, I got the keys to the kingdom. Yeah, you can do it. I'll let you out. He says, you can do that? He says, yeah, I'm the pope. I can do this. So Guido says to him, okay. He says, what you do is the city is controlled by the Colonna family, which is one of the important Roman families at the time. He says, what you do is you promise them if they surrender to you, you give them all an amnesty. But when they surrender, arrest them all and take over everything. Right. So that's what happens. It goes on. Right. So Guido gets his papal pardon and goes back to the monastery, and he thinks everything is okay. But then he dies, and this is what happens. St. Francis, he's a Franciscan now, St. Francis comes down to take him up to heaven. This has to do, by the way, with whether the principle of non-contradiction can hold even at the moment of death. So Guido says to Dante, Francis came afterward when I was dead, for me. But one of the black cherubim said to him, take him not, do me no wrong. He must come down among my servitors because he gave the fraudulent advice from which time forth I have been at his hair. For who repents not cannot be absolved, nor can one both repent and will at once, because the contradiction, non-contradiction, which consents not. Here's Guido speaking again. Oh, miserable me, how I did shudder when he seized on me, saying, perhaps thou didst not think I was a logician. That's the devil saying he's a logician. It's a great line in Dante. The theoretical discussion that takes place in the middle of in Canto 11 of Inferno has an echo in Purgatorio. And some of you probably know, the modern political philosopher Leo Strauss, very famous, very influential philosopher at the University of Chicago, had this theory about the secret teaching that in pre-modern times, when most people lived under despotism, they had to hide the primary message of their text, and it usually would be somewhere near the center of that text. And you should look there. Well, in Cantos 17 and 18 of Purgatory. Now remember, we've got 100 cantos, right? So 17 and 18 are very close to the center of Purgatory. And there's a moment when the two poets, the sun has gone down, so they can't advance any further, and they're in the cornice of the lazy, those who've been afflicted by laziness. And so it's a kind of a place where you try to figure out, well, you know, what is going on? Where are we going? What's going to happen? So Virgil says, look, as long as we've got this time, let me explain the situation to you. And here's what he says. Neither creator nor his creature was ever without love, natural or rational, as you know. The natural is always without error, but the other love may err by evil ends or by too much or too little ardor. while it's directed toward the primal good and toward the secondary goods keeps measure, it cannot be the cause of sinful pleasure. But when it's bent on evil or runs after the good with more or less zeal than it should, those whom he made then work against their maker. From this you can conceive how love must be the seed in you of every other virtue and every deed deserving punishment. Now here there's quite a bit of Aristotle and St. Thomas, right? There's excess and defect and some other things like that that come out of the ethics. But there's also a kind of an Augustinianism, you know, lurking in the back here as well, because Augustine in the City of God actually talks about how the virtues are forms of love. And I think that's something that Dante has in mind when he says. So anyway, so far so good. Neither creator nor creature was ever without good. But how does this actually work, this love that is directed toward goods? And here's where Virgil shows that there's something else that's got to happen in addition to the kind of pagan reasoning, or just normal human reasoning that goes on. I'm going to read you kind of a long passage, but it's worth knowing about this. As much as reason sees here, I can inform you. Beyond that, just wait for Beatrice. Beatrice being a kind of a woman who's a conduit of divine grace to Dante, specifically Dante. Since it is a point of faith and reason here, every substantial form that is distinct from matter, human soul, and is yet united with it, holds a specific power in itself, which is not seen except in operation, and only in its effects is it shown as the life of a plant in its green leaves. And so man does not know where understanding of his first ideas derives, nor where affection for his first objects of desire, which both are in you as instinct in the bee for making honey. And this primal will has no merit for either praise or blame. Now that all the other wills conform to this one, you have the innate powers which give counsel and which should guard the threshold of consent. This is the principle from which derives the reason for your merits, so far as it garners and winnows good and evil loves. That's the voice of pagan reason. It knows that somehow we're given these primal directives, sort of, from God, or from somewhere, from nature somewhere, but can't figure out where. It's only when Beatrice, only when with the coming of revelation, that the things that reason itself is seeking are finally going to have their culmination, that they're finally going to be explained. Augustine famously called evil the mysterium iniquitatis, the mystery of iniquity. And even evil, it's not only good loves, but it's even evil loves that are not a rationally resolvable problem. They're something that are presented to us. I'd like to go to the very end of the poem, to that last canto of Paradiso. Because in the next lecture, I want to talk a bit about how the end that we're tending toward not only sets loves in order, but it enables us to understand what the order of the loves is. With Virgil, I'm saying that we cannot simply, by normal, everyday, street-level human reason, arrive at not only the vision of God, but to truly know in a definitive way the way that the loves sort themselves out into a certain order. So it's in this final canto that a very funny thing happens. Dante has come all the way up through the heavens with Beatrice, who I want to say again is his personal initial conduit of grace. If you've read the Vita Nuova, which by the way means the new life, the new life that comes is when he meets her and love awakens him to stuff that he didn't know existed prior. The great modern Catholic philosopher Joseph Pieper has a book about Plato's Phaedrus, in which he says that there are four or five things that enable us to come outside of ourselves and to begin to transcend ourselves. One is human loves, love of parents for children, children for parents, two lovers who fall in love with one another, a husband and wife who are married, etc. Illness, strangely, because it's a kind of a crack in our normal everyday existence that may, a lot of people through suffering come to an understanding of things. There are occasionally kind of prophetic inspirations that take place. It's kind of rare, but even in modern times there are some instances of this. And the other, he says, is poetry. The kind of imaginative, something is given to us through our imagination. We think it's our imagination, and we create things. Whenever I talk about this, I'm reminded that there's a great ballet arranger, George Balanchine. I don't know if any of you have ever heard of him. He used to work with Igor Stravinsky and did these classic ballets. He was a Russian Orthodox, a serious Russian Orthodox believer. And someone once said to him, oh, Mr. B, you're just so great a creator. And he said, no, God creates, I arrange. And that's what basically what the imagination does, unless it's touched by something higher. And something like that happened to Dante. You know, I was going to do this in the next lecture, but let me read this to you since we have the time. When Dante gets near the end of the Vita Nuova, he's been in love with Beatrice, and in the coy way of medieval love, he can't express it, and women are always laughing at him in Florence, and he's walking around kind of hangdog, you know, and whatnot. And finally, some of them say to him, look, if you really love this woman, you wouldn't constantly be complaining about her. It's kind of like, you know, my baby done me wrong. It's like with every pop song that's ever been written. No, you'd be inspired by her. You know, you'd be uplifted. You'd be happy. And he says, you know, they're right. They're right about that. But then she dies. She dies quite young, in her early 20s. So he says, toward the end of the Vita Nuova, he says, a marvelous vision appeared to me, in which I saw things that made me decide not to say anything more about this blessed lady until I was capable of writing about it, about her more worthily. To achieve this, I am doing all that I can, as surely she knows, so that if it be pleasing to him who is that for which all things live, and if my life is long enough, I hope to say things about her that have never been said about any woman. Now, ladies in the audience, if that doesn't move you, I can't help you. Then if it be pleasing to him who is the Lord of benevolence and grace, may my soul go to contemplate the glory of its lady, that blessed Beatrice, who gazes in glory into the face of him, qui est per omnia saecula benedictus. So we don't know exactly what this is, and a lot of scholarly debate has gone on about what is this vision that takes place at the end of the Vita Nuova. But we do know that after that, Dante spent 3 years studying philosophy and theology, so much so he says that his vision actually became blurry. When he would look up at the stars at night, the stars looked blurry to him from eye strain. And ever after that, he had a special devotion to St. Lucy, who is an early Christian martyr. You may remember she had her eyes gouged out, so she was the patron saint of vision. And at the beginning of the Divine Comedy, there are three ladies who are moved to bring grace down to Dante. It's the Blessed Virgin Mary, it's St. Lucy, and it's it's Beatrice. So he's had this insight of some kind. He's had this miraculous vision of some kind. And we're led to believe, as we get near the end of the comedy, that what he's approaching is what he was inspired by way back there in the Vita Nuova. There's a quotation sort of in the middle of canto 33, very last canto of the Divine Comedy, where he says, that my eyes are dazzled as I look deeply into this mystery of light that that is the origin of all things. There's one point in the Paradiso where he and Beatrice are still traveling upward, and he's always looking in her eyes and seeing light there, and that's his inspiration. He's got, but as he gets to a certain point, he has another insight, and he realizes that the light he sees in her eyes is not coming out of her eyes, and he turns around, and he sees this bright star it's the most piercing light in the entire universe. And she says to him, "Ah, you finally realized." She said, "From that point of light hangs the entire universe." Amazing thing. So he gets to the light in this final canto, and he says, "Within its depths I saw gathered together, bound by love, into a single volume, leaves that lie scattered through the universe, substance and accident and their relations. I saw as though they fused in such a way that what I say is but one simple light." Now, I know of no other poet who's been able to take abstract concepts like substance and accident out of Aristotle and St. Thomas and so beautifully fuse them in verses like he's done here. That those things that we distinguish with the natural human reason, as Aristotle did, you know, substance and accident and all these sorts of things, right? Those he finds all united into a single volume by love. Then this is the true order of love. Augustine and Aquinas coming together in this point. But he goes further. Brilliantly. He takes an example from, of all things, geometry. Now, you know, we're at the height of Christian vision, and who in his right mind is going to think about geometry at this point? But Dante's imagination is so powerful that he does. And what he uses this for is to help us appreciate the incarnation, the mystery of the incarnation. Because this, too, how does God become man? How are man and God together in the person of Jesus Christ? It's a mystery. But what he says in this final canto is this. He sees the human form affixed to a circle, sort of like that Leonardo drawing, you know, that you see with the proportions of the human body, the man in a circle. But there are three circles. It's the Trinity. And the human form is united with the three circles in the Trinity. And he says this. "O everlasting light, you dwell alone in yourself, know yourself alone, and known and knowing, love and smile upon yourself. That middle circle, which appeared in you to be conceived as a reflected light after my eyes had studied it a while, within itself and in its coloring, seemed to be painted with our human likeness, so that my eyes were wholly focused on it." So in essence, what he's saying is that the incarnate human body is somehow in the upper reaches of the heavens is still there with God. And he goes on here, and this is the brilliance, I think. "As the geometer who sets himself to square the circle and who cannot find for all his thought the principle he needs, just so was I on seeing this new vision." Now, I don't think in math we use the term squaring the circle so much any longer, but what he's talking about here is trying to find the number pi. What is the relationship between the diameter or the radius of a circle and the circumference? And, you know, supercomputers have been running this for years on end, and they can't, it's an irrational number, as we say, right? It doesn't ever come to an end. But there clearly is, in reality, some relationship between the radius or the diameter and the circumference of a circle. And so brilliantly, even without the use of supercomputers, Dante is able to say here that what's there is not available to us via human reason, but it's real. It's real just in the same way that the value of pi is somehow real. But human reason is not left helpless in spite of this mystery, this impasse. And it's ultimately both Thomistic and Augustinian notions that come together in this final vision. Because what happens is grace grants what the human power cannot do at this point. And to be able to build in this into the shape of the comedy, it seems to me, and to make this reflect what the final order of loving is going to be, is just this ultimate vision that I never grow tired of reading. It's worth reading this canto over and over and over again, because it starts with St. Bernard is saying a prayer to the Virgin Mary. And it kind of anticipates what's going to happen here at the end, because he starts out by saying, Vergine madre, figlio del tuo figlio. Virgin mother, daughter of your son. Umile e alto più che creatura. Humble and exalted more than any creature. And he goes on and on with this series of apparent contradictions that somehow are going to be ultimately resolved and unified. And then he finally says, you know, I want you to intercede so that grace can be granted him for the final vision. And then he even goes further and says, but I ask this also, that once he's had this vision, that his human faculties not be damaged, not be impaired. Because this is transhumanism in the most literal sense. I'm going to talk about this in the next lecture. So now he gets to the point where that grace has got to operate. And here's what those final verses say. Remember, he's trying to figure out the pi, right? Yet my wings were not meant for such a flight, except that then my mind was struck by lightning through which my longing was fulfilled. Here powers failed my high imagination, but by now my desire and will were turned like a balanced wheel rotated evenly by the love that moves the sun and the other stars. So please read that whole canto. There's nothing like this in all of literature that I'm familiar with. Anyway, I'm going to leave that there for your comments and questions. And the next time out, I'm going to try to situate that final love in and show the way that it reflects back on the meaning of a lot of other things as a final end, final cause and a final end, how it reflects back on other things in Dante's universe. Thank you.
So I've had the privilege of listening to you speak once before, and what you said about Paolo and Francesca really sort of stuck with me and bothered me. So I've had time to think about it. I'll ask you then to defend Dante against what I accuse him.
All right.
He says that this is less of a sin because it's closer to natural love, but it seems to me that this is less about what Francesca does with Paolo and more about how she doesn't love her husband. So in that respect, it seems like it's more against natural love to seek love elsewhere, having someone who it's already more natural to love.
Well, look, just as every place, there's a line in the Paradiso that every place in heaven is paradise. There isn't a line in Inferno that says this, but I'll say this, everywhere in Inferno is hell. So, sure, the sin and the punishment in the order of loves seems to be lighter, but it's the gateway. It's the beginning of the self-indulgence, where instead of being focused on God, you begin to turn, at least you're turning toward a person, is the way I think Dante would put it, and I would put it too. At least you're not running after gold, or you're running after food or drink or whatever it is. So it's extremely dangerous in the sense that Minos says, beware of who you listen to, because the entrance here is easy. And I think one of the reasons why the church counsels against that is, look, most of us are not going to have even the temptation to rob a bank or to betray a lord, you know, which are the deepest sins, or you know, to commit fraud or something like that. But this is a very common thing. Even Pope Francis has spoken about this, that it's, you know, flesh is weak and it's kind of a common sin. I think it's bad to talk about it in that way, because it makes it easier to rationalize what perhaps you already want to do. I was talking with a Baptist preacher one time in a Catholic-Protestant dialogue down in Washington, and he told me that when he deals with people who are committing adultery, they never say that adultery is good. They just say this adultery is good, that God wants this adultery to take place. So you're, I think you're right to point out the danger there. I don't know that the husband thing comes into it so much because I think he deliberately tried to set up a difficult case. It's the kind of thing we've been debating with Amoris Laetitia in the church right now, that what happens when you have a loveless marriage and the guy's kind of brutal, he might even be a wife beater. Jesus still tells us that a man who divorces his wife and causes her to marry another or himself remarries commits adultery. What happens then? Do you have separations? You know, what do you do? But whatever other things we want to add, whatever other concerns, and I think you're right to raise that concern, the point still stands. The point still stands that, well, he himself even feels some sympathy in the way he writes about it. He still puts him in hell.